Monsieur le Président.
Mr. President, ladies and gentlemen, in speaking to this assembly, I would like, first of all, to express to you, Mr. President, my deep gratitude for your kind words. My thanks go also to the Secretary General, Mr. Ban Ki-moon, who has invited me to visit the headquarters of this organization, and to thank him for the welcome which he's given me. I greet the ambassadors and the diplomats of member states and all those who are present. Through you, I send greetings to the peoples that you represent here. They expect from this institution that it will put into practice the founding ideals. In other words, that it should be a center for harmonizing the actions of nations in the attainment of these common goals of peace and development. As Pope John Paul II expressed in 1995, the organization must be a moral center where all nations of the world feel themselves at home and develop a common awareness, so to speak, and feel a family of nations. Through the United Nations, states have set out universal objectives which, even if they do not fully coincide with the well-being of the human family, nevertheless represent a fundamental part of it. The founding principles of the organization, the desire for peace, the sense of justice, respect for the dignity of the individual, and cooperation and humanitarian assistance are the expression of just aspirations of the human spirit and represent the ideals which must underlie international relations. Like my predecessors, Paul VI and John Paul II have stated from the same podium, this is all part of the realities that the Catholic Church and the Holy See regard with attention and interest. They see in your activity an example of the way in which problems and conflicts affecting the international community can benefit from common settlement. The United Nations give form to the aspiration for a higher level of organization at the international level, which must be inspired and guided by the principle of subsidiarity and therefore be able to respond to the demands of the human family thanks to effective international rules and the implementation of ways to ensure harmony in people's daily lives. This is even more necessary in the current context, where we are witnessing the clear paradox of the multilateral consensus, which continues to be in crisis because it is still subordinated to the decisions of a small number, while the problems of the world require from the international community that it act on a common basis. Indeed, the questions of security, the development goals, the reduction of inequalities, both locally and globally, the protection of the environment, natural resources and the climate, require that all leaders in the international community should act together and be ready to work in good faith in the respect of the rule of law to promote solidarity in the most fragile regions of the planet. I'm thinking in particular of certain countries in Africa and on other continents who are still excluded from a full, genuine development and which risk only to experience the negative effects of globalization. In the context of international relations, we must recognize the primordial role of rules and structures, which by their nature are instituted to achieve the common good and therefore to safeguarding human freedom. These rules do not limit freedom. On the contrary, they promote it when they prohibit conduct and actions which go against the common good or which hamper the effective enjoyment of freedom and which compromise, therefore, the dignity of every human being. In the name of liberty, there must be a correlation between rights and responsibilities on the basis of which every individual is called upon to shoulder his or her responsibilities in the choices he or she makes while taking account of the fabric of relations with other people. We're thinking here of the way in which the results of scientific research and technological progress have sometimes been used. While recognizing the immense benefits that humanity can draw from them, some of their uses constitute a clear violation of the created order, to the point not just of being in contradiction with the sacred nature of life, but deprive the individual and the family from their natural identity. In the same way, international action aimed at conserving the environment and protecting various forms of life on Earth must not only ensure a rational use of technology and science, but must also rediscover the authentic image of the creation. It will never be a question of having to choose between science and ethics, but rather of adopting a scientific method which must genuinely respect ethic imperatives. Recognizing the unity of the human family and the attention given to the innate dignity of every woman and every man now finds a new impetus in the principle of the responsibility to protect. This was defined only recently, but it was already implicitly present at the origins of the United Nations, and currently it characterizes more and more its activity. Each state has the overarching duty to protect its population against serious and repeated violations of human rights, as well as the consequences of humanitarian crises due to natural causes or resulting from man's activities. If states are unable to guarantee such a protection, it is then up to the international community to intervene with the legal means that are provided for under the Charter of the United Nations and by other international instruments. The action of the international community and of its institutions, to the extent that it respects the principles that underlie the international order, should never be seen as unjustified coercion or as being a limitation on sovereignty. On the contrary, it is indifference or non-intervention which cause the real harm. A in-depth study must be made of the ways to prevent and manage conflicts by using all the means that diplomatic action has at its disposal, while giving attention to and supporting even the slightest sign of dialogue and the desire for reconciliation. The principle of the responsibility to protect was considered under the long-standing jus gentium as the basis of any action undertaken by the authority towards those who were governed by it. When the concept of the national sovereign state emerged, the Dominican monk Francisco de Vitoria, considered correctly as a precursor of the idea of the United Nations, described this responsibility as an aspect of natural reason that is shared by all nations and is the fruit of international law, whose task was to govern the relations between peoples. Now, as was the case then, such a principle must reveal the idea of the human person as being in the image of the Creator, and also the absolute desire and the essence of liberty. The creation of the United Nations, we all know, coincided with earth-shaking events that humanity suffered when the reference to the sense of a transcendence and to natural reason were abandoned, and as a result, liberty and human dignity were violated on a huge scale. In such circumstances, this threatens the objective foundation of the values that inspire the international order and undermines the intangible and binding principles that were formulated by the United Nations. In the face of new repeated challenges, it would be an error to hide behind a pragmatic approach, which would be limited to establishing common bases with a minimum content and with a limited effectiveness. The reference to the human dignity as the foundation and goal of the responsibility to protect brings us to the theme of this year, which marks the 60th anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. That document was the fruit of a coming together of different cultural and religious traditions, which were all inspired by the common desire to place the human individual at the center of its institutions, laws, and the action of societies, and to consider it as essential for the world of culture, religion, and science. Human rights are more often presented as a common language and the ethic underpinning of international relations. Just like their universality, their indivisibility and their interdependence are all guarantees of protecting human dignity. But it is clear that the recognized rights that are set out in the Declaration apply to every individual, and that is because of the common origin of people, who remain the central point of the creative design of God for the world and for history. These rights find their basis in natural law, enshrined in the heart of man and present in his various cultures and civilizations. To separate human rights from this context would limit their scope, and give way to a relativist conception according to which the meaning and interpretation of rights could vary and their universality could be denied in the name of different cultural, political, social, and religious conceptions. The great variety of points of view can never be a motive for forgetting the fact that these are not only rights which are universal, but also the human person who is the object of these rights.
Life of the community, both domestically and internationally, clearly demonstrates that respect for rights and the guarantees that follow from them are measures of the common goods that serve to evaluate the relationship between justice and injustice, development and poverty, security and conflict. The promotion of human rights remains the most effective strategy for eliminating inequalities between countries and social groups and for increasing security. Indeed, the victims of hardship and despair, whose human dignity is violated with impunity, become easy prey to the call to violence, and they can then become violators of peace. the common good that human rights help to accomplish cannot, however, be attained merely by applying correct procedures, nor even less by achieving a balance between competing rights. The merit of the Universal Declaration is that it has enabled different cultures, juridical expressions, and institutional models to converge around a fundamental nucleus of values and hence of rights. Today, so efforts need to be redoubled in the face of pressure to reinterpret the foundations of the Declaration and to compromise its inner unity so as to facilitate a move away from the protection of human dignity towards the satisfaction of simple interests, often particular interests. The Declaration was adopted as a common standard of achievement and cannot be applied piecemeal according to trends or selective choices that merely run the risk of contradicting the unity of the human person and thus the indivisibility of human rights. Experience shows that legality often prevails over justice when the insistence upon rights makes them appear as the exclusive result of legislative enactments or normative decisions taken by the various agencies of those in power. When presented poorly in terms of legality, rights risk becoming weak propositions divorced from the ethical and rational dimension which is their foundation and their goal. The Universal Declaration, rather, has reinforced the conviction that respect for human rights is principally rooted in unchanging justice, on which the binding force of international proclamations is also based. This aspect is often overlooked when the attempt is made to deprive rights of their true function in the name of narrowly utilitarian perspective. Since rights and the resulting duties follow naturally from human interaction, it is easy to forget that they are the fruit of a commonly held sense of justice, built primarily upon solidarity among the members of society and hence valid at all times and for all peoples. This institution was expressed as early as the 5th century by Augustine of Hippo, one of the masters of our intellectual heritage. He taught that saying, "Do not do to others what you would not want done to you," cannot in any way vary according to the different understandings that have arisen in the world. Human rights, then, must be respected as an expression of justice and not merely because they are enforceable through the will of the legislators. Ladies and gentlemen, as history proceeds, new situations arise and the attempt is made to link them to new rights. Discernment, that is, the capacity to distinguish good from evil, becomes even more essential in the context of demands that concern the very lives and conduct of persons, communities, and peoples. In tackling the theme of rights, since important situations and profound realities are involved, discernment is both an indispensable and a fruitful virtue. Discernment then shows that entrusting exclusively to individual states with their laws and institutions the final responsibility to meet the aspirations of persons, communities, and entire peoples can sometimes have consequences that exclude the possibility of social order respectful of the dignity and rights of the person. On the other hand, a vision of life firmly anchored in the religious dimension can help to achieve this, since recognition of the transcendent value of either men and women favors conversion of heart, which then leads to a commitment to resist violence, terrorism and war, and to promote justice and peace. This also provides the proper context for the interreligious dialogue that the United Nations is called to support, just as it supports dialogue in other areas of human activity. Dialogue should be recognized as a means by which the various components of society can articulate their point of view and build consensus around the truth concerning particular values or goals. It pertains to the nature of religions freely practiced that they can autonomously conduct a dialogue of thought and life. If at this level too, the religious sphere is kept separate from political action, then great benefits ensue for individuals and communities. On the other hand, the United Nations can count on the results of dialogue between religions and can draw fruit from the willingness of believers to place their experiences at the service of the common good. Their task is the preservation of faith, not in terms of intolerance, discrimination and conflict, but in terms of complete respect for truth, coexistence, rights, and reconciliation. Human rights, of course, must include the right to religious freedom, understood as the expression of a dimension that is at once individual and communitarian, a vision that brings out the unity of the person while clearly distinguishing between the dimension of the citizen and that of the believer. The activity of the United Nations in recent years has ensured that public debate gives space to viewpoints inspired by a religious vision in all its dimensions, including ritual, worship, education, dissemination of information, and the freedom to profess and choose religion. It is inconceivable then, that believers should have to suppress a part of themselves, their faith, in order to be active citizens. It should never be necessary to deny God in order to enjoy one's rights. The rights associated with religion are also more in need of protection if they are considered to clash with a prevailing secular ideology or with majority religious positions of an exclusive nature. The full guarantee of religious liberty cannot be limited to the free exercise of worship, but has to give due consideration to the public dimension of religion, and hence to the possibility of believers playing their part in building the social order. Indeed, they actually do so. For example, through their influential and generous involvement in a vast network of initiatives which extend from universities, scientific institutions and schools to healthcare aid agencies and charitable organizations in the service of the poorest and most marginalized. Refusal to recognize the contribution to society that is rooted in the religious dimension and in the quest for the absolute, by its nature expressing communion between persons, would effectively privilege an individualistic approach and would fragment the unity of the person. My presence at this assembly is a sign of esteem for the United Nations, and it is intended to express a hope that the organization will increasingly serve as a sign of unity between states and an instrument of service to the entire human family. It also demonstrates the willingness of the Catholic Church to offer a proper contribution to building international relations in a way that allows every person and every people to feel they can make a difference in a manner that is consistent with her contribution in the ethical and moral sphere and the free activity of her faithful. The Church also works for the realization of these goals through the international activity of the Holy See. Indeed, the Holy See has always had a place at the assemblies of the nations, thereby manifesting its specific character as a subject in the international domain. As the United Nations recently confirmed, the Holy See thereby makes its contribution according to the dispositions of international law, helps to define that law, and makes appeal to it. The United Nations remains a privileged setting in which the Church is committed to contributing her experience of humanity, developed over the centuries among peoples of every race and culture, and placing it at the disposal of all members of the international community. This experience and activity, directed towards attaining freedom for every believer, seeks also to increase the protection given to the rights of the person. Those rights are grounded and shaped by the transcendent nature of the person, which permits men and women to pursue their journey of faith and their search for God in this world. Recognition of this dimension must be strengthened if we are to sustain humanity's hope for a better world, and if we are to create the conditions for peace, development, cooperation, and guarantee of rights for future generations. In my recent encyclical Spe Salvi, I indicated that every generation has the task of engaging anew in the arduous search for the right way to order human affairs. For Christians, this task is motivated by the hope drawn from the saving work of Jesus Christ. That is why the Church is happy to be associated with the activity of this distinguished organization, charged with the responsibility of promoting peace and goodwill throughout the earth. Dear friends, I thank you for this opportunity to address you today, and I promise you of the support of my prayers as you pursue your noble task. Before I take my leave from this distinguished assembly, I should like to offer my greetings in the official languages to all the nations here represented. Peace and prosperity with God's help. Paix et prosperité avec l'aide de Dieu. Paz y prosperidad con la ayuda de Dios. Selemon, wa istiharun bianilech. In so tien chu de banzo, yenda chia de shian, ping an che fan rong. Mira y guagostienstvia spomoschu Bože. Thank you very much.